it became very clear that this is about more than two little words, banned guns. So that is not the answer, that there are a wide range of issues at play.
This is Family Policy Matters with NC Family President John Rustin.
Thanks for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. Safety, particularly in schools, is at the forefront of our minds these days, especially in light of the recent violent tragedies that have taken place in Parkland, Florida, and elsewhere across our country. Today, we're fortunate to be joined by Lindsay Burke, Director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. We'll be discussing some of the intricacies surrounding this issue and where the research suggests our efforts may be best directed as we really seek to keep our children, our teachers, and staff safe while at school. Clearly, this is a critically important issue and a very complex issue as well. Lindsay, welcome to Family Policy Matters.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Lindsay, let's begin with kind of some big picture perspective on this issue of school violence. How does the rate and severity of school violence across our nation compare with sort of the history of what we've seen in our country?
Well, certainly any violent incident in a school involving a child is tragic. But Columbine-style shootings are actually quite rare, thankfully, since about the 1990s, America's 100,000 or so public and primary schools have experienced about 22 on-campus shootings that resulted in two or more fatalities. So that's, if you average it out, that's less than one multiple fatality shooting each year. And of course, one is one too many.
Sure.
But the idea that these Columbine-style shootings are something that we see frequently, thankfully, is not the case. And since 1990, there has not been any steady rise in shootings. So that is the good news. If you look back to the mid-1990s and the early 1990s, there were four times as many children who were killed in schools in the 1990s than today. And that number's been really declining pretty steadily over the past 30 years.
Well, that's interesting, and I think that's an important perspective, just so that we look at the reality of the situation. I know with media coverage and clearly the well-founded concerns that we all have about school violence, that it may seem to some that there's been a significant increase in recent years, but that really is not the case. Although it is good that we're having a heightened level of sensitivity and awareness of this issue. Now, speaking of this issue too, Lindsay, what are some of the variety of factors that are most important to consider as we seek to have a truly productive and honest conversation about how to make our schools more safe?
Well, one thing that we have focused on here at Heritage is exactly what you said. How do we have this productive and honest conversation? And it became very clear that this is about more than just, you know, our president here likes to say, it's about more than two little words, banned guns. So that is not the answer, that there are a wide range of issues at play. School violence is related to a wide range of issues. And so as part of that range of issues, one of the most critical is the underlying cultural factors that are related to youth violence. And that would include primarily the creation and the maintenance of stable and strong and intact families. And that's really important and unfortunately something that we have seen moving in the opposite direction over the years. So in addition to fostering strong families, which would go a long way in a lot of these crises, there's also the school level side and the policy side of this, which involves allowing schools to actually punish student misbehavior when it occurs and to punish it effectively without worrying that they are going to be penalized themselves through federal policy. During the Obama years, the Obama administration really attempted to tie access to federal funding to school policies that limited discipline measures such as school suspension. And that was something that was promulgated in what was known as a 2014 Dear Colleague letter. So rescinding that guidance, which is something that the current administration is considering and should do, would go a long way in restoring decision-making authority back to schools when it comes to student misbehavior and discipline.
Well, that's so important, just the overall aspects of individual responsibility. And I really appreciate so much what you shared about the importance of family structure. When the family starts to unravel, the impacts of that across our society are just enormous. And I think that that's what we've seen in many of these circumstances.
That's right. And you cannot overstate the importance of intact families. Family is just so important. Unfortunately, a majority of the school attackers have come from broken homes. You know, these are homes where we see divorce and domestic violence, absentee fathers. So it's really unfortunate to see some of these school attackers had really experienced some pretty serious family instability. And that goes for, you know, Parkland and Sandy Hook and others, just to name a few. I would say that does not mean that children, obviously, from broken homes should be viewed as threats at all.
Sure.
But I do think that it requires that we recognize just the critical importance that family, intact family, plays in that fundamental role of childhood development.
So true. Now, another issue that's really come to light and has become an area of focus is mental health. How does mental health factor into the overall equation of school safety and the individuals that we have seen perpetrate some of these crimes in recent years?
Yeah, that has become an increasing focus. And, you know, I do think it is good that we're sort of in the policy world broadening our focus on some of the factors that have led to some of these tragedies, mental health being one of them. School staff, I would say, need to be better trained to recognize the signs of mental health. And I should note, too, that we should make a distinction between severe mental illness and just general mental health. But school staff do need to be trained in recognizing those severe mental health issues. Right now, there is typically in a district school only one counselor per 500 students. There's only one nurse per 1,200 students. So I don't think that the answer there is more spending, but it is really empowering schools to have more say over how they allocate their resources and how they administer and allocate staffing positions. One thing that we know is that while there are few counselors and nurses per student, that we've actually seen the inverse over the past few decades of just general administrative staff. So non-teaching staff in school has really just exploded over the past few decades. If you look back to 1950, there were 2.36 teachers for every non-teacher in a typical school district, and today it's 1 to 1. So there's a lot of, for lack of a better term, administrative bloat in schools. So if schools had the ability to better direct those resources on their own instead of having to jump through hoops to satisfy federal regulations and requirements, I think we could see them better allocate resources, which would have, I think, a positive downstream effect on the mental health side.
You're listening to Family Policy Matters, a resource from NC Family. To listen to our radio show online and for more resources that will help you be a voice of persuasion in your community, go to our website at ncfamily.org.
Well, Lindsay, you mentioned this earlier too, but gun laws often become a hot button topic when we discuss school safety. Based on your research and knowledge of this issue, do you believe that the laws that we have in place regarding guns are sufficient, or do you think that more laws and regulations are necessary?
Well, I will say that my area of expertise is education policy and not the Second Amendment. However, my colleagues here, John Malcolm and Amy Swear, have done really fantastic work in this space. One thing that they have pointed out in a lot of the research that they've published recently is that the majority of school shooters under the minimum age to purchase a gun had obtained one legally that was already owned. And so school safety, I think, really needs to be considered outside of the gun control debate and not be limited to gun control. I mean, we see in China, unfortunately, 18 children died in a knife attack in 2010. So it really is, I think, something that necessitates a far broader conversation than just gun control.
Well, it's an easy sort of topic to jump onto and for folks on all sides of the political spectrum to attempt to use to their advantage to push a particular agenda. But I think, as you've well stated throughout our discussion so far, there is far more to this issue than guns. So we really need to take a look at the whole picture and all of these different aspects. Now, Lindsay, from the perspective of security, What changes can schools implement relatively quickly and easily that will help to increase the safety of student, teachers, and other staff in the school?
Yeah, so, you know, armed security guards, those are one good resource, but they can be expensive for a school to implement, and particularly to implement multiple such security guards. One of the, as you said, sort of low-hanging fruit, easier changes might be the use of door barricades in schools. So these are small wedges that can be placed in door frames within seconds that will prevent intruders from physically entering a room. So there are some easier and lower cost fixes that schools could pursue. But I go back to this need, really, for schools to have more autonomy over the dollars that they're currently spending. If we could free up some of the red tape and the regulations that are handed down from Washington and actually empower principals and school leaders to make these decisions about how to best allocate their resources, that could go a long way in helping them, whether it's prioritizing armed security guards or other types of school hardening mechanisms, they would be able to do that. There was a proposal floated by Senator Alexander, who is the chair of the Senate Education and Labor Committee, and he basically suggested doing what I just described, which is to allow schools to really have more control over the dollars that they spend and really allow them to use the existing funds that are already spent through federal policy toward whatever local school safety priority they might need to address.
Well, Lindsay, what is the appropriate responsibility and cooperation between different levels of government? For example, the school systems, the schools on the ground, and our state and federal government to address this topic most effectively and most appropriately?
Well, as I mentioned, I think first and foremost, we really need to free up states and localities to do what they do best, which is understand the local environment in which they operate. They have the local contextual knowledge to know what they need to do on school safety. And so have the federal government really kind of free up the red tape there that might bind the hands of state and local leaders. But then down at the state level, there's also there are quite a few areas in which states and local leaders could better work together. One example would be across state lines to have better communication about what works. There are districts and states, some across the country, who do a good job of this. North Carolina is a good example, where they actually have all of the state agencies, so the health agency and State Department of Ed and others, actually get together, do conference calls about school safety. Now, what we need to do is export some of that across state lines and actually share these best practices. And then at the end of the day, I think we need to ensure that parents are actually able to find schooling options that are a good fit for their child as well. We know that school safety is one of the biggest priorities for parents when they're choosing a school. And that can go to, far beyond this conversation, but into a conversation about bullying and just other general school safety measures at the student level. So ensuring that families have access to options that work for them, of course, would be part of that as well.
Well, and that's a great lead into my final question for you, and that is, what can parents and students do from a practical standpoint to help to make their schools and those environments safer?
Well, I think continuing to be as active as possible. In Florida, in Broward County, we have seen parents really step up, and students in particular, really step up, be part of the conversation in terms of school board meetings and meetings at the school, PTA meetings, et cetera. We also, I will say, at Heritage, we have a lot of resources for parents and students and policymakers, but on our school safety initiative for parents and students in particular. So there's a lot out there. But I think being part of the conversation, attending those school board meetings, is really critical.
Well, Lindsay, please share with our listeners where they can go to get information about this school safety issue and other information, a great wealth of information that the Heritage Foundation provides.
Well, thanks so much. So you can visit heritage.org, and there are two areas on our site that you can check out for more on this. One is our school safety initiative, which you'll see prominently. And then the other, for general education policy, we have a whole education initiative as well that you can click on there, but heritage.org. And I would also recommend the dailysignal.com, all of the great resources there.
Great. Well, Lindsay Burke, thanks so much for being with us on Family Policy Matters and for all your great work at the Heritage Foundation on this very important issue of education.
You've been listening to Family Policy Matters, a production of NC Family. To listen to our radio show online and for more valuable resources and information about issues important to families in North Carolina, go to our website at ncfamily.org and follow us on Twitter and Facebook.